వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సభప్రభ నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా శివశక్త్యా యుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి అత స్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Om Shri Sai Ram, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning, greetings and loving Sai Ram from Prashanthinilayam. And with me, Team Radio Sai Sunil, welcoming you to this morning segment, Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashanthinilayam. Today is the 12th of December 2019. And let me, as always, first read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. As parents, how should we raise children? And what is the critical lesson about material wealth we must impart to them? Bhagwan gives us a clear and loving exposition today, and I quote, "It is not wrong to love children, but parents should learn how to love them. Whenever children go astray, wittingly or unwittingly, parents should hasten to correct their faults and bring them to the righteous path. The obligations of parents do not end with providing food, schooling and knowledge on worldly matters. Children should also be provided with right values. They should not be made to think that the acquisition of wealth is the be-all and end-all of life. Wealth does not accompany one when they leave the world. Wealth is necessary only for meeting one's essential needs. Too much wealth is an embarrassment, like an oversized shoe. Too little of it is likely to be painful, like a tight-fitting shoe. So it is desirable to have only that amount of wealth that is adequate for one's basic needs. It is deplorable that in the mad pursuit of money, people are forgetting or compromising human virtues." Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on February 5th, 1984. Dear listener, today in Divine Glory, I have lined a few readings from the English version of the holy book, Sri Sai Satcharitra by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by the first part of a Tryst with Divinity conversation with Mr. Raj Srivatsan from the United States. First, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemant Pant. We are thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. And at 11:30, Bishu will join you with his segment, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. So please stay tuned and here it is for your listening pleasure.
There are other schools where you see an altogether different spectacle. The disciples go there to seek knowledge and spend the money, time and labor, but ultimately they don't gain much. The guru there boasts of his secret knowledge and his straightforwardness. He makes a show of his sacredness and holiness. He speaks a lot and sings his own glory, but his own words do not touch the disciples' heart, and they are not convinced. So far as self-realization is concerned, he has not reached that. How can such schools be of any use to the disciples, and how can they be benefited? The guru mentioned above was of different type. By his grace, realizations flashed upon me of itself, without effort or study. I had nothing to seek. Everything became clear to me as broad daylight. The guru alone knows how the inverse suspension with head down and feet up can give happiness. Among the four, one was a karmaka, who knew how to observe and abstain from certain rites. The second was dhyani, who was puffed up with pride of knowledge. And the third was a bhakta, who surrendered himself complete to God, believing that he was the sole doer. When they were discussing and arguing, the question of God came up, and they, depending on their unaided knowledge, went in search of him. Sai, who was discrimination and dispassion incarnate, was one of the four. On being himself Brahma incarnate, some may ask, why did he get mixed with them and act foolishly? He did that for setting an example to follow. Though an incarnation himself, he respected a low banjari by accepting his food with the firm belief that food is Brahma, and showed how those who rejected banjari's hospitable offer suffered, and how it was impossible to get dhyan without a guru. The Shruti in the Taittiriya Upanishad exhorts us to honor and worship mother, father and preceptor, and to study the sacred scriptures. These are the means of purifying our minds, and unless this purification is effected, self-realization is not possible. Neither the senses nor the mind and intellect reach the self. Modes of proof such as perception and inference will not help us in the matter. It is the grace of the guru that counts. The objects of our life, such as dharma, artha and karma, are attainable with our effort. But the fourth object, moksha or liberation, can only be had with the help of the guru. In the life story of Sri Sai, many personalities appear and play their part. Astrologers come and give out their predictions, princes, noblemen, ordinary and poor men, sannyasis, yogis, singers and others come for darshan. Even a mahar comes and making his salutation says, Sai is a Mahabab who will do away with our rounds of births and deaths. So many others, such as jugglers, gondalis, the blind and the lame, natpantis, dancers and other players come and are given suitable reception. The banjari also appeared at the right time and played the part assigned to him. Let us now revert to the other story. Fasting and Mrs. Gokhale. Baba never fasted himself, nor did he allow others to do so. The mind of the person who fasts is never at ease. Then how could he attain his paramartha, goal of life? God is not attained on an empty stomach. First, the soul has to be appeased. If there be no food in the stomach and nutrition, with what eyes should we see God? With what tongue should we describe his greatness? And with what ears should we hear the same? In short, when all our organs get the proper nutrition and are sound, we can practice devotion and other sadhanas to attain God. Therefore, neither fasting nor overeating is good. Moderation in diet is really wholesome, both to the body and the mind. One Mrs. Gokhale came to Shirdi with an introductory letter from Mrs. Kashibai Kanitkar, a devotee of Baba, to Dada Kelkar. She came to Baba with a determination to sit at Baba's feet and observe a 3-day fast. The previous day, Baba said to Dada Kelkar that he would not allow his children to starve during the Shimga or the holy holidays, and that if they had to starve, why was he there? Next day, when the woman went with Dada Kelkar and sat at Baba's feet, Baba at once said to her, Where is the necessity of fasting? Go to Dada Bhai's house, prepare the dish of Puran Polis with wheat rotis and gram flour and jaggery, feed his children and yourself too. Shimka holidays were on. Mrs. Kelkar was then going through her periods and there was nobody to cook in Dada Bhai's house. So Baba's advice was very timely. Then Mrs. Gokhale had to go to Dada Bhai's house and prepare the dish as directed. She cooked that day, fed others and herself. What a good story and how beautiful its import. Baba's Sarkar. Baba gave a story of his boyhood as follows. When I was a youngster, I was in search of bread and went to Bid. There, I got embroidery work. I worked hard, sparing no pains. The employer was very much pleased with me. Three other boys worked before me. The first got 50 rupees, the second 100 rupees, and the third 150 rupees. And I was given twice the total of this amount, that is 600 rupees. After seeing my cleverness, the employer loved me, praised me and honored me with a full dress, a turban for the head and a shela for the body. I kept this dress intact without using it. I thought what a man might give does not last long and is always imperfect. But what my Sarkar or God gives lasts to the end of time. No other gift from any man can be compared to his. My Sarkar says, take, take. But everybody comes to me and says, give, give. Nobody attends carefully to the meaning of what I say. My Sarkar's treasury is full. It's overflowing, I say. Dig out and take away this wealth in cartloads. The blessed son of a true mother should fill himself with this wealth. The skill of my fakir, the leela of my lord, and the aptitude of my Sarkar is quite unique. What about me? Body will mix with earth, breath with air. This time won't come again. No matter where I go or where I sit, Maya always troubles me much. Still, I'm always anxious for my men. He who does anything, spiritual endeavor, will reap its fruit. And he who remembers these words of mine will get invaluable happiness. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 33. Greatness of Udi. Scorpion sting and plague cases cured. Jamnar miracle. Narayan Rao's sickness. Balabua Sutar. Appa Saheb Kulkarni. Hari Bhav Karnik. In the last chapter, we described the greatness of the Guru. Now, in this, we will describe the greatness of the Udi. However, both are interlinked. The greatness of Udi is due to the spiritual grandeur of Baba. Preliminary. Let us now bow before the great saints. Their merciful glances will destroy mountains of sins and do away with all the blemishes of our character. Their talk gives us good teachings and confers on us invaluable happiness. Their minds do not know any difference, such as this is ours and that is yours. Such differentiation never arises in their minds. Their debts, obligations will never be repaid by us in this birth as well as in many future births. Udi. It is well known that Baba took Dakshina from all, and out of the amount thus collected, he spent on charity and purchased fuel. This fuel he put in the dhuni, the sacred fire, which he kept ever burning. The ash from this fire was called Udi, and it was freely distributed to the devotees at the time of the departure from Shirdi. What did Baba teach by this Udi? Baba taught by this Udi that all the visible phenomena in the universe are as transient as the ash. Our bodies composed of matter of the five elements will fall down after all the enjoyments are over and reduced to ashes. In order to remind the devotees of the fact that their bodies will be reduced to ashes, Baba distributed Udi to them. Baba also taught by the Udi that the Brahma is the only reality and the universe is ephemeral, and that No one in this world, be he her son, father or wife, is really ours. We come here in this world alone, and we have to go from here alone. It has been found that the Udi cured many physical and mental maladies, but Baba wanted to repeat into the devotee's ears the principles of discrimination between the unreal and the real. He taught non-attachment for the unreal by his Udi and Dakshina. The Udi taught us discrimination and Dakshina taught us non-attachment. Unless we have these two things, it is not possible for us to cross over the sea of the mundane existence. So Baba asked for Dakshina. And while the devotees took leave, he gave Udi as prasad, smeared some of it on their foreheads and placed his boon conferring hand on them. When Baba was in a cheerful mood, he used to sing merrily. One such song was about Udi. The meaning of the song was, O playful Ram, come, come and bring with you sacks of Udi. Baba used to sing in very clear and tender tones. So besides the spiritual implication of Udi, it had also its material significance. It conferred health, prosperity, freedom from anxiety and many other worldly gains. So the Udi has helped us gain both our ends, material as well as spiritual. We shall now begin with the stories about the Udi. Scorpion Sting. Narayan Motiram Jani of Nasik was a devotee of Baba. He was serving under another devotee of Baba by name Ramchandra Vaman Modak. Once he went to Shirdi with his mother and saw Baba. Then Baba himself told her that her son should start independent business. Some days after this prophecy turned true, Narayan Jani left service and started a boarding house, Anand Ashram, which thrived well. Once a friend of this Narayan Rao was stung by a scorpion and the pain caused by it was severe and unbearable. Udi is most efficacious in such cases. It is to be applied on the point of pain and so Narayan Rao searched for it but found none. Then he stood before Baba's picture and invoked Baba's aid, chanted Baba's name and taking out a pinch of the ashes of the joss stick burning in front of Baba's picture and thinking it as Baba's Udi, applied it on the seat of pain and the sting. As soon as he moved his fingers, the pain vanished and both the persons were moved and felt delighted. Bubonic Plague Case. Once a devotee in Bandra came to know that his daughter, who was staying in another place, was down with bubonic plague. He had no Udi with him, so he sent word to Nana Sahib Chandorkar to send the same. Nana Sahib got this message en route Thana railway station when he was travelling with his wife to Kalyan. He had no Udi with him then. He therefore took up some dust from the road, meditated upon Sai Baba, invoked his aid and applied it to his wife's forehead. The devotee was very glad to learn that his daughter, who was suffering for 3 days, began to improve from the very moment Nana Sahib invoked Baba's aid near the Thana railway station. The Jamnar Miracle. In the year 1904-05, Nana Sahib Chandorkar was Mamlatdar at Jamnar in the Khandesh district, which is more than 100 miles from Shirdi. His daughter Mainatai was pregnant and was due to deliver. Her case was very serious and she was suffering from labor pains for the last 2 or 3 days. Nana Sahib tried all remedies but in vain. He then remembered Baba and invoked his aid. There in Shirdi, one Ramgir Bua, whom Baba called Bapugir Bua, was leaving for his native place in Khandesh. Baba called him and told him to stop at Jamnir on his way home and give the Udi and Arati to Nana Sahib. Ramgir Bua said he had only 2 rupees with him and this amount was barely sufficient for the railway fare up to Jalgaon and it was not possible for him to go from Jalgaon to Jamnir, a distance of about 30 miles. Baba assured him that he need not care as everything would be provided for. Then Baba asked Shama to write a well-known arati composed by Madhav Adkar and gave a copy of it with Udi to Ramgir Buwa to be delivered to Nana Sahib. Then, relying on Baba's words, Ramgir Buwa left Shirdi and reached Jalgaon at about 2:45 a.m. He had only two anas left with him and he was in a plight. To his great relief, he heard somebody calling out, "Who is Bapugir Buwa of Shirdi?" He went to him and told him that he was Bapugir Buwa. Then the person, professing to be sent by Nana Sahib, took him to an excellent tonga with a good pair of horses. They both drove in it. The tonga ran fast and early in the morning they came to a brooklet. The man took the horses for watering them and he asked Ramgir Buwa to partake of some eatables. On seeing that person's beard, moustache and livery, Ramgir Buwa suspected him to be a Muslim and was unwilling to take any refreshments from him. But the man satisfied Ramgir Buwa saying that he was a Hindu, a Kshatriya of Garhwal, and that Nana Sahib has sent these refreshments and there should be no difficulty in its acceptance. Then both of them took the refreshments and started again. They reached Jamner at dawn. Ramgir Buwa alighted to attend a call of nature and returned within a few minutes but found there was no tonga and no driver. He was dumbfounded. Then he went to the neighboring kacheri and on making inquiries learned that the Mamlatdar was at home. He went to Nana Sahib's house and gave Nana Sahib Baba's Udi and Aarti. At this time, Maina Thai's case was in the most serious condition and all were in deep anxiety about her. Nana Sahib called out his wife and asked her to give the Udi mixed with water to their daughter to drink. He thought that Baba's help was most opportune. In a few minutes came the news that the delivery was safe and that the crisis had passed away. When Ramgir Buwa thanked Nana Sahib for the pyun, tonga and the refreshments, Nana Sahib was greatly surprised, as he had sent none to the station and was not aware of any person coming from Shirdi. Mr. B.V. Dev of Thana, retired Mamlatdar, made inquiries about this matter with Bapu Rao Chandurkar, son of Nana Sahib, and Ramgir Buwa of Shirdi, and after satisfying himself, wrote an elaborate article, part prose and part poetry, in the Sri Sai Leela magazine, volume 13, number 11, 12 and 13. B.V. Narasimha Swami has also taken down the statements of Maina Thai and Bapu Sahib Chandorkar and Ramgir Buwa, dated 1st June 1936, 16th September 1936 and 1st December 1936 respectively, and published them in his Devotee's Experiences Part 3. The following is quoted from Ramgir Buwa's statement. "One day, Baba called me to him and gave me a packet of Udi and a copy of Baba's Aarti. I had to go to Khandesh at the time. Baba directed me to go to Jamnir and told me to deliver the Aarti and Udi to Nana Sahib Chandurkar at Jamnir. I said to Baba that all I had was 2 rupees and asked him how that could take me by train from Kopargaon to Jalgaon and next from Jalgaon to Jamnir. Baba said, 'God will give.' That was a Friday and I started at once. I reached Manmad at 7:30 p.m. and Jalgaon at 2:45 a.m. At that time, plague regulations were enforced and I had much trouble. I was to discover what I should do to get to Jamnir. At about 3 a.m., a peon in boots, turban and equipped with other details of good dress came to me and took me to a tonga and drove me on. On the way at Bhaghur, I took refreshments. We reached Jamnir early in the morning and by the time I attended my call of nature, the tonga and its driver had disappeared."
Narayan Rao.
Bhakt Narayan Rao had the good fortune to see Baba twice during the latter's lifetime. 3 years after the passing away of Baba in 1918, he wanted to come to Shirdi but could not. Within a year of Baba's Mahasamadhi, he fell sick and suffered much. All possible remedies gave him no relief, so he meditated on Baba day and night. One night, he had a vision. Baba came through a cellar, comforted him, saying, "Don't be anxious. You will be improving from tomorrow, and within a week, you will be on your legs." Narayan Rao got perfectly well within the time indicated in the vision. Now the point for consideration is this. Was Baba living because he had the body, or was he dead because he left it? No, Baba is ever alive, for he transcends both life and death. He who loved him wholeheartedly gets response from him at any time and at any place. He is always by our side and will take any form, appear before the devout Bhakta and satisfy him.
Appa Saheb Kulkarni.
In 1917, Appa Saheb Kulkarni was transferred to Thana and began to worship Baba's picture presented to him by Bala Saheb Bhatte. In real earnest, he did the worship. He offered flowers, sandal paste and naivedya daily to Baba in the picture and longed intently to see him. In this connection, it may be remarked that seeing Baba's picture earnestly is equal to seeing him in person. The following story illustrates this statement. Balabhuva Sutar. A saint of Mumbai named Balabhuva Sutar, who on account of his piety, devotion and style was called modern Tukaram. He came to Shirdi for the first time in 1917. When he bowed before Baba, the latter said, "I know this man since 4 years. Balabhuva wondered and thought, how could that be, as that was his first trip to Shirdi? But thinking about it seriously, he recollected that he had prostrated himself 4 years ago before Baba's portrait at Mumbai. He was convinced about the significance of Baba's words. He said to himself, how omniscient and all-pervading are the saints, and how kind are they to the devotees. I merely bowed to his photo, but this fact was noticed by Baba. And in due time, he made me realize that seeing his photo is equivalent to seeing him in person." Now, we return to Appa Saheb's story. While he was in Thana, he had to go on tour to Bhiwandi and was expected to return after a week. In his absence, the following wonderful thing took place on the third day. At noon, a fakir turned up at Appa Saheb's house. His features resembled exactly those of Baba's photo. Mrs. Kulkarni and the children all asked him whether he was Sai Baba of Shirdi. He said no, but that he was an obedient servant of his and came there at his order to inquire after the well-being of the family. Then he asked for Dakshina. The lady gave him a rupee. He gave her a small packet of udi and asked her to keep this in the shrine. Then he left the house and went away. Now hear the wonderful leela of Sai. Appa Saheb could not proceed with his tour as his horse fell sick at Bhiwandi. He returned home that afternoon and learned from his wife about the fakir's visit. He got very restless as he did not have the darshan of the fakir. Moreover, he did not like that only 1 rupee was paid to him as dakshina. He said that had he been present, he would have paid not less than 10 rupees. Then he immediately started in quest of the fakir and searched for him in the masjid and other places without taking any food. His search was in vain. He then returned home and took his food. The readers may remember that Baba's dictum in chapter 32, God's quest should not be made on an empty belly. After his meals, he went out for a walk with a friend, Mr. Chitre. After going some distance, they saw a man approaching them rapidly. Appa Saheb thought he must be the fakir that came to his house at noon, as his features tallied with those of Baba in the photo. The fakir immediately put forth his hand and asked for dakshina. Appa Saheb gave him a rupee. He demanded again and again, and so Appa Saheb gave him 2 more. Still, he was not satisfied. Then he borrowed 3 rupees from Mr. Chitre and gave them to him. He wanted still more. Appa Saheb asked him to accompany him to his home. Then they all returned home and Appa Saheb gave him 3 rupees, in all 9. He looked unsatisfied and demanded again. Then Appa Saheb told him that he had a currency note of 10 rupees. The fakir asked for the same, took it and returned the 9 rupees and went away. Appa Saheb had earlier said that he would pay 10 rupees, and that sum was taken from him, and 9 rupees, consecrated by Baba's touch, were returned to him. The figure 9 is significant. It denotes the 9 types of devotion, It may also be noted here that Baba gave 9 coins to one Lakshmibai Shinde at his last moment. Appa Saheb examined the udi packet and found that it contained some flower leaves and akshata. Then some time afterwards, he got a hair from Baba when he saw him at Shirdi. He put the udi packet and the hair in a taviz and wore it always on his arm. Appa Saheb realized the power of the udi. Though he was very efficient, he got 40 rupees as pay in the beginning, but after he secured Baba's photo and his udi, he got many times more and also got much power and influence, and along with these temporal benefits, his spiritual progress was also rapid. So those who are fortunate enough to get Baba's udi should, after bath, apply it on the forehead and take some of it mixed with water as holy teerth. Haribhav Karnik. In 1917, Haribhav Karnik of Dahanu in Thana district came to Shirdi on the Guru Purnima day in the month of Ashad and worshipped Baba with all the formalities. He offered clothes and dakshina and after taking Baba's leave, got down the steps of the masjid. Then he thought he should offer one more rupee to Baba and was just turning to climb again when Shama signaled him by gesture that as he had got Baba's leave, he should go and not return. So he started for home. On his way, when he went into the temple of Kala Ram at Nasik for darshan, the Saint Narsik Maharaj, who used to sit inside the temple, came to Haribhav, caught him by the wrist and said, "Give me my 1 rupee." Karnik was surprised. He paid the rupee most willingly and thought Sai Baba recovered the rupee which he intended in his mind to give through Saint Narsingh Maharaj. This story illustrates the fact that all saints are one and illustrates how they work in unison. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Shri Guru Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Satguru Shirdi Baba.
Mangala Giridhar Sai Baba,
Mangala Giridhar Sai Baba,
Shri Guru Purna Sai Baba,
Shri Guru Purna Sai Baba,
Karuna Sagar Sai Baba,
Karuna Sagar Sai Baba,
Nitya Niranjan Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Shri Guru Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Satguru Shirdi Baba.
to Sight.
Spend the day with Sight.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Saram, dear listeners, and welcome to Tryst with Divinity, our series of conversations on Radio Sai with people who have been touched by the love of Bhagwan. Today is October 10, 2016, the ninth day of the Dasara celebrations in Prashantinilayam, the festival when we adore the Lord as the Divine Mother. And I'm grateful to Bhagwan for sending to the studios today someone who has in real life lived and experienced that dictum, Mother is God. And in turn, God has blessed him with the love of a million mothers and more. Mr. Raj Srivastan from the US. He had his first darshan of Swami as a 13-year-old in Abbotsbury, Chennai. But Bhagwan had visited his home, to his mother's home, way back in the 50s, in 1951 to be precise, and in fact had revealed to her, to his mother, about the birth of Raj as well as his two siblings. After that rendezvous with Bhagwan as a teenager, he saw Swami once again after 20 years in 1993, and that was a life-changing moment. The journey of his soul after that had many moments of chills and thrills, experiences that were deeply depressing and completely incapacitating, to moments which were absolutely enlivening and resurrecting. He saw Swami again in 2005, and then in 2008, when his life was in complete disarray and everything around him only appeared dark, hopelessly dismal and utterly devastating, now Swami went to him. How did this happen? And what did this do to him? And how has his soul's journey been since then? Well, that is going to be what we are going to hear today. So it is really going to be a very moving and enlightening conversation. But before we get on to it, let me take a minute to mention about his accomplishments in his professional sphere. Mr. Raj is now an experienced corporate and securities attorney with a management consulting background, practicing in the US for 18 years now. He is engaged in class and derivative litigation as counsel for the boards of Fortune 500 companies and engaged in defending directors and officers through the US corporate law firms. He has assisted justices and judges of the Supreme Court of Delaware and federal bankruptcy courts in public service, also at the US Securities and Exchange Commission's Enforcement Division to prosecute Wall Street corporate and securities fraud. In fact, he has contributed immensely to the successes in various kinds of financial fraud prosecutions against big banks, working beside the US Department of Justice and other watchdog agencies. He has used his sharp legal skills to fight against adharma, against injustice done to disabled persons, to neglected and abandoned children, to abused and battered women. He fought against the termination of parental rights, his work to protect abused prisoners, and his work for senior citizens who were victims of fraud, and so on. The list goes. In India, he practiced law for 2 years, and during this time, he stood against overbilling and other medical practices done by rich corporate hospitals in India. This is one of the many other things that he did in India before he moved to the US in 1999. Understandably, he has a string of impressive educational qualifications in India, UK and US educational systems with senior Cambridge schooling and degrees in physics, bachelor's and master's in law, master's in business administration specializing in finance, as well as master's and juris doctor degrees in law in the US. Thanks to his extensive qualifications, he is admitted to practice law in India, in the US Supreme Court, as well as in the state bars of New York, Delaware, Washington DC and US federal courts. He also has a broad work experience, Before his first bar admission in 1997, he worked in sales, marketing, management and entrepreneurship involving small and multi-million dollar projects in the pharma sector, in the engineering sector, in shipping, in media, and also offered management and turnaround consultancy. He even established an import-export business in London, and in 1997, he worked with the top London firm Simmons, advising the Bangalore city and the Karnataka state government on strategies and legal framework for implementing their $2.5 billion Bangalore Metro Rail project. The Bangalore Metro Rail project, as many probably know, is called Namma Metro, and it is in fact India's second largest metro system in terms of both length and number of stations. Besides all these laurels in his career as a businessman, business consultant, and then as a distinguished lawyer, Mr. Raj is also a martial art expert. He has in fact studied martial arts, including Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do, which is a form of Chinese Kung Fu. In his college days, he was a keen cricketer too, having been one of those very good players who was part of this Ranji Trophy Probables from the state of Tamil Nadu. So yes, there is so much to him, but among all these achievements and distinctions spanning over five decades, for Mr. Raj, what is most cherishable is the chance that he received in 2015 to teach the students of Bhagwan in all the campuses. He has now visited and taken classes in corporate governance and financial management in Puttaparthi, that is the Prashantiniam campus, in Vrindavan campus, in Mudunelli campus and Anandpur campus of Sri Sakti Sai Institute of Higher Learning. Even though he's a guest faculty in India's premier institutes like Indian Institute of Management in Bangalore and National Institute of Fashion Technology, for him to be serving Bhagwan's educational mission directly is in fact a very precious gift and blessing from the Lord. In fact, he's here now in India doing this duty. Very happily, he has spent time in August 2016 teaching in the classes to the girl student of Anandpur campus, and after that he stayed on in India to visit some of India's ancient glory and heritage, and now he is back in Prashantiniam to soak himself in the light and delight of Dasara. And really, he is in bliss, just connecting with his inner Sai in the peace of Prashanti. And his journey to Sai, with Sai, has deep and meaningful lessons that all of us can benefit from. And that is how, and probably that is why Bhagwan has sent him to the studios on this beautiful day when we are about to celebrate the Purnahuti of the Veda Purusha Saptah Gyana Yajna that's been going on in Prashantiniam for the last 1 week. So welcome Mr. Raj Shivasan to Tryst with Divinity on Radio Sai.
Sai Raman, thank you very much for this opportunity. My prayers at the lotus feet for this opportunity.
So, Bhagwan declared his avatarhood when he was 14 years old. And when you were 13, 14, he declared himself to you.
Isn't that quite a coincidence?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So tell us the story of how as a teenager, when you saw Bhagwan, what impact it had on you. And how did that happen?
Sure. Perhaps I should just rewind it a little bit in terms of time. From the age of 11, I think, if I'm right, I was always curious about life, what life meant, mm-hmm. what was life about.
Age of 11?
Yes. So I picked up books about Ramana Maharishi,
mm-hmm.
and I went through those. And of course, as you can understand now and appreciate, Vedanta was pretty heavy for 11-year-old.
I know.
To understand that.
No, was it because you had a religious background? Or
no, it was just something innate within me.
Okay.
I had that curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not specifically put my finger on what it was all about, but mm-hmm. I had this curiosity, and I would go to bookstores and I would peruse the spiritual section.
Mm-hmm.
And those days on Mount Road in Chennai, they would have these old books sold on the platform in mm-hmm. front of LIC building.
Mm-hmm.
And I would stop by and I would look at Ramana's books and I would pick them up. And as an 11-year-old, I remember I even picked a book on the Upanishads, but of course, all those went above my head. But the reason I'm bringing that up is because Swami, of course, knew that, him being omniscient. And as I know, and as a number of experiences in the past, which I can discuss about as we go through these interviews. So I guess Swami really knew what was in my heart, and he perhaps knows about me as he knows past, present, future.
So nothing in this physical life, in this birth, I mean, really prepared you or molded you towards that direction when you were just 10, 11 years old. So it is something that perhaps you were born with.
It appears so. Because you wouldn't find very many 11 years old looking for spiritual books and even possessing spiritual books. I do remember some of the first books I possessed were spiritual books, Ramana's books. And one day my friend, I won't mention the year, but it was quite a while ago, a friend of mine who used to play cricket with me in school, he was about 7, 8 years older to me. He told me, let's go because God is coming to town. This was in Chennai. For a 13-year-old at that time, you know, hearing the word God coming to town, it's almost like the embodiment of a physical body coming to town. And I was kind of stupefied. I said, what? Did you say God? And he said, yes. And I said, are you crazy? How can God come to town? He said, look, why don't you just come with me and let's go across. So we went to Abbotsbury. We were cycling buddies. So we cycled to Abbotsbury, about 3-4 miles away. And Swami came to me, physically, within handshaking distance. He stopped in front of me. He looked knowingly into my eyes, and he smiled. And he raised both his hands, and he gave me Abhyahasta blessing. Then he looked at me with a wicked smile, which I know now what it meant, because as the years unfolded, a lot of events happened. And he then walked away. That was my first encounter with divinity.
But did it make any impression on you? Because you were someone, as you mentioned, 2 years prior to that, you were already reading a lot of spiritual books and you were trying to find answers for various questions, meaning of life and so on. So did that encounter with Bhagwan help in this process in any way?
Again, I need to build a little context into this. It did, but in a different way. I was very skeptical. And I'm always a skeptical person, and I guess that's the reason I became a lawyer. I don't believe things easily. I believe people easily, but I don't believe statements or such positions easily. Let me put a little flesh to that skeleton. My family believed in all kinds of ochre-robed sages and saints, and for me, it was something that I did not really take to, because India is full of ochre-robed rogues. And I was a little cautious that Bhagwan was also a rogue. And it was a wrong impression, but Swami himself has said that you should come, you should experience, and then you should make up your mind. You should never believe anything blindly. And I guess I was following that dictum unconsciously within myself. So when he first came to me, it didn't have a positive effect at all. In fact, on the other hand, it stirred in me a little opposition to him. And that opposition, as it turns out, was really a healthy opposition, because it made me think more about what this was all about. And over the years, that curiosity has fueled my search for meaning. And then the experiences of Swami, which he gave me, brought everything home.
So it was a mixed sort of experience.
Very much so.
So on one hand, I think there was something about Swami which you were stunned, or sort of you were mesmerized, or you were perhaps fascinated
it
to some extent.
Me. He intrigued me.
Yeah.
That's as best as I can put it. For a 13-year-old, he intrigued me. He looked charming. He had a very beautiful face, smooth, wonderful black hair. Swami was around 45 or so around that time, as you know, 48, probably 50, close to 50. And he was only 5'3" with his hair. So it made a huge impression, like this tiny little form. And there are thousands of people out here, maybe 15,000 people out there. So I said, he's got to have something about him which draws people. But I failed to feel that at that time. So it took me a long while to actually feel that. It's not an instantaneous recognition of divinity at all.
Yeah.
It took a while.
You just knew that he's something else. He's something special.
Yes. Something special. But he bears investigation by me. As a 13-year-old, that might sound a little arrogant, but I guess I was a little precautious in suspecting these things then, not just accepting things blindly. But one of the most intriguing factors here was I didn't go with my parents. I went by myself with a friend. And for a 13-year-old, that's a little odd. I guess when it's your time, you go.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as life progressed, were you constantly thinking about what happened in that year, or that was one of those events that happened and you after that life was as usual?
A very interesting thing happened before this event. There was a palmist who visited my grandfather's home in Gandhinagar, and he was reading everybody's palm. He was an IIT graduate, and he read my palm and he said, whether or not anybody else sees God, this boy is going to see God.
And when did this happen?
This happened at just around that time.
Oh, okay.
This is before, this preceded Swami's visit.
And of course, there is also the episode of Swami coming to your mother's home.
I didn't know about that then. Because it was not significant. This we came to know a little later. Because nobody really took interest in Swami. I didn't take interest in Swami. And my mother didn't think that it was necessary to mention that to me because there was no significance and no context. Because I rejected ochre robed rogues, as I said.
So until that moment, mother also had never mentioned about this.
No, she did not mention it to me because it had no significance. I would not be interested because I was against saints. I was against these ochre robed persona in India.
Your parents were devoted? Or your parents?
My mother was. My father has had several darshans. Nothing that we really discussed about in cozy terms. All this came about much later, 20 years later, when Swami came.
So after that, life was as usual. You went ahead doing your education and stuff.
I was in school, and my life was not usual. It actually regressed in lots of ways. The difficulties, my life was strewn with obstacles, with hurdles, and I had to work very, very hard, even in school, even in college, subsequent to that as well. Nothing was easy for me. Nothing came easy in my life, except my sports. My sports came easy, studies came easy, but nothing else came easy.
So we next saw Swami only after 20 years.
Yes.
And that was a very different experience than what it was when you were a 13-year-old.
Yes, it was an extraordinary experience. Really extraordinary. Nevertheless, I was still sitting on the fence, but it was an extraordinary experience. Looking back now, I can scarcely believe that I experienced that. 20 years later, my mother was paralyzed, and she was paralyzed for over 6 years. Around the same time, my father was ill as well for a year, year and a half. And I was taking care of them alone in Chennai, in the third floor apartment, without an elevator. I had no siblings with me to assist, no relatives, and not even house help. So I was doing everything myself. I know it's one of those strange situations that life throws you in. To top that also, I was doing my MBA at the same time. And I completed my MBA right on top of the class, the top three ranks, at the same time. And I'd also begun my law at the same time. How I was able to jostle all of these things at the same time was really incredible. And that is the power of the divine, on how he gives you a problem, he gives you the strength to handle it as well. In 1993, my father came to know that Swami was coming down to Chennai. At those days, I did not know or call him by the word Swami. That came much later when Swami prompted me to call him by that epithet. So we had to take my mom. My mom, being devoted to him and my father also having a lot of faith in Swami, wanted to go to Abbotsbury, the very same venue where Swami had first seen me and blessed me. So I had to prepare my mother. Being bedridden, I had to do everything, the rituals for her, and then take her in a car to visit. And Mount Road, the road which leads to Abbotsbury, was closed, and ours was the only vehicle. And we were not allowed in because it was around close to 9 o'clock, and Swami would come in for darshan at that time in his red BMW car that he had then. One thing led to another thing, and we were wondering what to do, and the police wanted to shoo us away from there. And all of a sudden, this gentleman in crisp white clothing with a clipped accent, perfect English, very smart looks, comes out of the ladies section. Now, that was a red flag. because as you know, Swami does not countenance men coming on the ladies' side or ladies coming on the men's side. There's a clear segregation of the two. And this gentleman just popped out of thousands of women and came right up to the car. There was no fence dividing Abbotsbury from the main road. So he came up and he asked me in a clipped accent, he said, "What seems to be the problem? You can't park your car here. You'd have to move your car because Swami's car will be coming anytime." He said, "Baba's car will be coming anytime." And I said, "Look, we are here because my mother would like to get Swami's darshan and I can't move the car." He said, "You would have to." I said, "All right, ask the lady, and if she's willing to move the car, we'll move the car." And he asked the lady and she said, "I want to see Baba." So he said, "Even if you want to see Baba, the gate is closed. You can't drive in because there is no access and we also don't have a wheelchair. So there's no way you can get in over there to the disabled person section." So he said, "You'd have to move." And I said, "All right, I can move her if you would like me to move her. I can do that." He said, "We don't have a wheelchair." And I said, "I am a wheelchair. I'll carry her." you got to mentally understand the scheme of Abbotsbury. We are on Mount Road. Imagine a rectangle adjacent to that, and about 100 yards distance from there to the enclosure where he eventually wanted to take us. And then there's this sea of women sitting between the road and the enclosure. And we had to walk. The only access was walking through the women.
Mm.
And you know, as I just mentioned, Swami does not countenance that. But then again, you know, these rules, Swami bends them in appropriate circumstances, as I came to know that day. So he said, "Pick up your mother." And I picked up my mother in my arms. She weighed about 150 pounds, 155 pounds then. Just lifted her up in my arms and walked through those women. And this seems like Moses parting the ocean, you know, the Red Sea. I was walking up there with my mom in my hands. My dad was walking behind me with the bags, food for her, water, and towels and so on and so forth. And this gentleman was leading us right in front. And it was like the ocean of women were parting. And the three of us were walking across. And we went into that enclosure, which was nothing but a back, it's kind of like a backyard, but with walls about 5 feet in height. And there was an access from the back, which we went through. And there's an access from the front, which Swami came in later, as I will talk about. It was about approximately 150 feet, probably, the length of that enclosure, and about 70 feet in width. And there was nothing in it except some discarded furniture and so on and so forth, you know, which was discarded from the main bhajan hall and convention center. And that is connected to the bhajan convention center hall. And we walked in there and he said, "Put your mother on the ground." And the ground was concrete and I could not do so because she's paralyzed. I can't put her on the ground. She hit her head. So I said, "I can't do that." He said, "What do you need?" I said, "I need a chair." All of a sudden, a chair just comes out from nowhere, folding chair. And then he puts a folding chair in a particular spot, which at that moment did not strike me as significant, but later on it proved to be extremely significant, as I'll mention. So I put my mother on the chair, and it didn't have arms. Now, she's paralyzed, so she could fall. And so I'm fixing my eyes on her, and I can move from her side because I'm conscious of the fact if she rolls and hits the concrete with her skull, she's going to have a fractured skull. So I was standing by her side, and the gentleman asked me, he said, "Anything else?" And I said, "No." And he says, "All right, Baba's car should be coming anytime." And he's rolling in, I'm going. And he walked out, and he disappeared. And for me, what do I think? Where did he go? Who is this gentleman? I have never come across such a gentleman ever on that day again or ever after that. But he disappeared, and exactly at that time, Swami's car approached, parked in the portico, and then the function proceeded.
Wow.
Well, a lot of things happened after that. Would you like me to
tell
you
about that? Of course.
A lot of things happened after that. Swami went into the foreground, and there were children putting on a cultural festival for him. This was January, early January, 1920, around that time of 1993. And my father was with us. And I told my father, and there's a history here. Sometimes, you know, parents, father doesn't get along with son. This was a case, my father was an army colonel. He had his way of doing things, and he didn't like me, approve of me, for lots of reasons, and his reasons. And I said, "Look, Dad, we don't get along, but stay with me. Because if you believe his divinity, it's important we get his blessings as a family, not individually. Because it shouldn't be that way. Because we are one unit." He said, "No, I'll get a better look from a cross. So he went out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason why I say this, because he turned around, Swami, after the program, about 25 minutes, 30 minutes. And then he walked back, and I could see his hair bobbing above the 5-foot wall. My mother was sitting on the chair, and my dad was out now. He was in Swami's entourage. I don't know how he got there, but he got there. And you know how it is, you can't really get in there close. But because we were in this unique spot, he was able to join that entourage. And my mother was asking me, said, where is he? Has he gone? And I was telling her, giving a running commentary. He's approaching, he's moving this way, so on. I was standing, she was sitting to my left, and I'm facing that enclosure. The enclosure is just shoulder width, a little more than my shoulders, probably about 3 feet in width, enough for an individual to walk through. And I was feeling really bad for her, because I don't know how long she'll live in her condition, and a prayer went out from my heart. Swami answers prayers which are genuine and unselfish. And my prayer was for her. I said, this lady loves you a lot. And she wants to see you. I don't know how long she's going to live. Could you please answer her prayer? And at that exact moment, I got a shock. Because just as that prayer left, he crossed that opening. I could see him now. He wasn't looking towards me. He was looking straight ahead. He turned around so quickly, swiveled on his foot. He swiveled. And it was a funny sight, because I'm trying to express what I saw. I paint the picture for you. Everybody else was caught on the foot, with the foot in the air. So they committed to their step and they could not stop. But he had already swiveled and he had run through that opening towards us. And all of them were committed, and it was like a frozen shot. You can see everybody in midair. They were committed. They couldn't come. And as soon as Swami ran, the Sevadal blocked the access. So my father got trapped outside. He couldn't come back inside. And Swami ran close to about 40 feet from that opening to us.
Wow.
He lifted his robe with his left hand, and he ran, verbalizing, what happened? What happened? What happened? You know?
Amazing.
And that was an amazing sight for me, looking at this bounding, orange, ochre-robed, now as I say, wonderful divine being running towards us. That stopped my heart.
A few minutes before, you were only able to see his hair, and now he's running towards you.
Running. Have you ever seen Swami run to anybody? He was running to us. And that was extraordinary. He ran, and he came up to me, and he asked me, he said, what happened? And I was still not conscious of the fact that this is a divine being. I was still sitting on the fence. But this shocked me. But then I thought in my mind, as an analytical person, perhaps it was a coincidence, because at that exact moment when I prayed, maybe it was just a coincidence that he came running. Perhaps he was curious when he saw two people standing there. That's what I thought. But then the whole set of events simply militated against that kind of intellectual cleverness, as Swami calls it. He ran, he asked me, he said, what happened? I gave him a string. I said, she's got high blood pressure. My mother's blood pressure was 270 by 210, which is extraordinarily high. And she had a stroke when it was around 280. And it fluctuated up and down. She was a COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease patient. She, her lungs had packed up. She had kidney problems. She had eyesight problem, peripheral sight. She had complete left side was paralyzed. So she had to be tutored to sit. A lot of issues, everyday physiotherapy, bedpan, everything was on the bed. And for her to be sitting on that without armrest, like the chair I'm sitting on right now, was extraordinary. And she didn't lose her balance at all. And I was keeping my eyes fixed on her, but at the same time trying to look at Swami and catch glimpses of him. And he came, stood right up there, and then he asked my mother, he said, how are you, in vernacular, in Tamil? And my mother just couldn't grasp. She was crying. Tears were streaming down because she could feel the bhakti. I could not, but she could. And then he started materializing something with his hand. That is the first time I actually saw him materialize something. The moment I saw his hand go that way, I started thinking, here comes a magic trick. And he stopped. And he looked at me. And he looked at me sarcastically, meeting my eyes. And my eyes were on his hand. And then he did something extraordinary. He read my mind. So he took his sleeve, right sleeve, and pulled it all the way up to his elbow. And then very mischievously looking at me, he continued with his wolves on the right hand and materialized Vibhuti. A beautiful white powder came out of nothing. And I was stupefied when I saw that. There's no question that he could have hidden it anywhere. No question it popped down a pill like people, you know, make up all these stories. I wonder what they would say if they saw him churning in the pot during Shivratri, you know. A never-ending supply of Vibhuti falling.
Dasara.
And yeah, Dasara. And it stopped when Swami pulled his hand out, it stopped. And then again he put his hand in and twirled, it would start again. Mm. And limitless supply of Vibhuti. Yes. But here it was a beautiful white, beautiful powder. White. I've never seen anything like that. Pure white, like talcum white. Mm. And smells beautiful. And he opened my mother's palm, put it on it. Then he put his three fingers and put this namam on her forehead, you know, Vishnu mark. Mm. And then he tipped the palm to her mouth, asked her to swallow it. And then he turned to me with so much of love. Mm. He turned and he caught my hands, my arms. He caught my shoulder first. Mm. And then he caught my arms, forearms. Mm. And he held it, almost like giving me that strength, that courage. And I was thinking in my mind, am I going to see a miracle like Jesus performed, making people walk? And that was the exact thought in my mind. And immediately the message flashes back to me, that's not the right thing to ask. Mm. And that was my lesson. You do not ask for things like that because there is a karmic process for each individual. They have to go through something. The better prayer is, in accordance with your knowledge of their needs, you please bless them. That's the perfect prayer for an individual. Not to save their life, not to cure them, nothing like that. Because he has better plans. Yes. And these reflections came later, you know, the meaning to all of this. And he just leaned forward and kept holding my hand and pressing my hand every time I had a thought. And that was beautiful. Having the Lord touch your hand is extraordinary. And then he withdrew his hand. And then he turned and he walked away. And when he walked away, when I looked to the right, that was when it hit me where the chair was placed. The chair was placed exactly opposite the doors which led directly to Swami's throne. And there was a red carpet from my mother's chair all the way to Swami's throne. That was a distance of about 70, 80 feet, 90 feet. And we got a ringside view. Where Swami's carpet ended, he sat and we were at the other end.
Wow.
And then the bliss tears started. And here's a black belt, a guy who's fought in the nationals, he's fought commandos and whatnot, and he was crying in public, in front of women. There were thousands of women, there were policemen standing, and I was crying. And I couldn't stop my tears. And I just looked at myself, you know, in the third person, and I was wondering, what am I doing? I'm crying, but I can't stop my tears. It just went on and on. It came in as paroxysms, which I later learned, Swami causes that with his aura.
Amazing. So a lot of cobwebs of the mind were cleared. A lot of love was experienced that I had never experienced before.
I would imagine so.
And I think it's very significant also that Swami held your arms.
Yes.
Because you were someone, as you mentioned, you were spending all your time looking after your parents, looking especially your mother who was not keeping well, and you had to do it all alone. And Swami is someone who always emphasized that one should always look after their parents, you know. Once, as Bhagwan in Telugu says, fuddu, duddu, bloodu, you know, your blood, your food, your money, your energy, your very being, everything comes from your parents. And Swami always, I don't think there is ever any discourse that he gave to the students and he did not emphasize this aspect of serving your parents. And you were doing that at that point in time with everything that you could muster physically and emotionally. And to me, it seems like it was a reward, it was a gift, it was acknowledgement of that service that you were doing to your mother.
I should say I was the beneficiary. I'm very fortunate when I look back now, taking care of my parents, even though my father was very obtrusive, I took care of him as well. Those were challenging days, very, very challenging. But it was a huge reward for me to be there and take care of both my parents at a time when they needed me and needed help. And I think I'm very fortunate to have had that opportunity when I was young, when I had the physical strength because I need to carry my mother down 3 flights of stairs and put her in a car, in my vehicle, that is a Maruti van, and rush her to the hospital numerous times in the dead of night, not knowing where I would need to put my foot. I couldn't see the steps in front of me. It was purely his guidance where my feet landed one after the other. One slip and both my mother and I would have gone over the parapet and fallen about 40 feet and died. And this happened for years. And this happened more than 200 occasions, climbing up and down. And that's the kind of duty and service that he enabled me to discharge to my parents, carrying both my mother and father. For 6 years. Yeah, my mom and my dad for about a year. So that was his blessing. And now when I look back, it's a very important duty that everybody should perform if they have the opportunity and the grace and the good fortune to do. And like he says, if you can't serve your parents, you really can't serve the world. It doesn't matter what you do for the world if you can't do it for your parents. I'm fortunate that way.
Amazing. And I think that encounter with Bhagwan in 1993, that way was significant in so many ways.
Yes.
Isn't it? At least one thing is, now you are more emboldened than before to serve your parents.
Yep.
In spite of whatever challenges.
Yes.
At home and elsewhere. And also now you had this source of energy and strength to bank on, which is Bhagwan, which you connected now, isn't it?
It's a really good point that you bring up about the source of strength, because in retrospect, I realized why he held my hands. Swami was actually giving me energy to handle what was going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And if I thought that he was rewarding me for what I did, I was wrong, because this was not a reward for what I did. This was giving strength for what was going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And what came next year was extraordinarily stupefying.
Mm-hmm.
All of 94, my mother was in intensive care on life support. And she went to a hospital about 5 different times. Mm-hmm. Each time on the ventilator for 2.5 months. In 2 different hospitals in Chennai. And that was an extremely difficult time in terms of physical, emotional, financial. It was a drain. My brother has been a huge support in this, my younger brother. Huge support, and I'm really kudos to him, because he bore his end financially and I bore this end financially as well as in terms of taking serving my parents. But what was the significance of that whole thing is it confused me about my conclusions about ochre-robed saints. And for me at that time, I neither understood whether Swami was a saint, divine or what, because I was still fighting with my intellectualism, you know. I'd still not allowed my heart to accept the divinity which was flowing. Although there were snatches of moments when I would wonder, this is divinity. And because of what I saw and what I experienced firsthand. But what he was really trying to do was bracing me for what was going to come. And that happened a year later, from January of 1994.
Mm-hmm. So what really happened that sort of was a life-changing moment for you?
It was, I would not wish this on anybody, but it was 17 months of incredible stress. 17 months. It was stress for my mother, because she was on the surgical end of all these matters at this time. Surgically intervened about 6 times. She was on tracheotomy. You know what is tracheotomy? Putting on life support, you know, a nasopharyngeal tube connected to a ventilator, and then they do an operation on the neck on the windpipe, and then put in a trachea and into your trachea, and then you're on a ventilator for 2.5-3 months. Some people come out of it, some people don't. My mother came out of it 5 times.
And she out of the ventilator?
Out of the ventilator, and she made medical history. She had already come out of the ventilator in May of 1992. And in 94, she came out of it 3 times. And in 95, she came out of it once. And then on the second time in 1995, she died.
Oh.
Her physical death. So those were very difficult times. And I was in the hospital 24/7, 365. I ran my management consultancy from the intensive care. The doctors, nurses, everybody understood that They rallied behind me. They supported me. But my residence was on the couch in the hospital in the intensive care. And I completed my MBA while in the hospital. And I began my law studies while in the hospital.
Wow. So when your mother finally passed on, what went through your mind?
There was one incident which happened which my then wife related to me. My mother passed on May 11th of 1995. But at the moment when she passed, my wife was then in Bombay when Sunil Gavaskar, former captain of the cricket team for India, was arranging an event in Dharmakshetra on 11th May 1995. And Swami gave a discourse on the duty of a son to parents, and he was talking about Lord Rama. Mm-hmm. And my wife was present because Dr. Fani Bandha, as you know, a very close devotee of Swami, a Zoroastrian gentleman and a dentist, well-known dentist, yes, in Bombay. He and I met in Bombay, and he invited my wife to attend this program. It was for a limited number of people. And the chief minister of Maharashtra was there, and a number of other dignitaries, and Sunil Gavaskar, of course. And my wife was present at around 8:15, 8:30 in the morning. And it was at that time my mother passed. Here's the shocking thing. She comes back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and keep in mind, there are no cell phones at that time. She comes back home, knowing that I'd called a couple of times, asking me what happened, and then before I could say anything that mother had passed on that morning, they were good friends, my mother and my wife. She told me, you won't believe what I have to say. And I said, look, I've got something really important to say. And she said, no, I got to say it first. And then she told me what it was. She said, look, strangest thing happened. I saw mom standing there next to Swami, wearing a blue sari, and looking great, and having these jasmine flowers in her hair. I've never seen her stand, but I saw her stand today. Is everything okay? And plus another thing, the letter that you gave me, and Swami accepts letters as prayers, as you know, and as most devotees know. And he accepted the letter that I had given and had scribbled something in it, but he returned it to her after he gave her blessings, Pada Namaskar. And she was confused, wondering why did he return the letter? She asked me, first, he returned the letter. Second, I saw your mother stand. Is everything okay? And I said, no, everything is okay now, because she passed on at 8:15 in the morning. And she was shocked. So she physically passed on in Chennai, but she was seen next to Swami in Bombay, a distance over 1,000 kilometers away, at exactly the same time.
And it was a clear vision to her.
Clear vision of her standing, not imagination, for over 40 minutes, as she related to me. And I had no reason to suspect her, because she is the one who described it, and she didn't know my mother had passed, and nobody knew my mother had passed. Only I knew, my father knew. That's all. Nobody else knew. And there were no cell phones those days, no internet. So there's no question of her ever having known. So this was Swami's way of letting her know divinity and letting me know that he knows when my mother passed. So for me, I'm a great believer in near-death experiences, if you know that area. Yes. I've read a lot. As I mentioned, from the age of 12, 13, I used to pick up books by Dr. Raymond Moody, mm-hmm, A Life After Life. And I would read those books about people who passed out of their body and came back into their body. And that kind of piqued my curiosity about death. And I was a student of death. I was trying to understand what happens after that. Is this the end? I didn't believe it was the end. That was why I picked up Ramana's book, looking for an answer. And then, of course, now Swami has given all the answers. Being a student of near-death experiences and of life and the process of death, I had no doubt in my mind at all that my mother had lived her life to the maximum. And she had gone at the right time when it was divinely appointed for her to leave her body at that time. So I was not in any way disillusioned. I was in fact happy for her, because that broken body, the suffering was over, and my mother had gone on to greener pastures.
Amazing. It's quite, it's such a significant moment when you think about, actually you feel so gratified, isn't it? All the time you served your mother, and finally she's there with the one with whom she will always be happy.
Precisely what Swami's message was at that time. And this is another thing that I would like to share with your listeners and you as well. That morning that she passed at about 8 o'clock, we had a discussion about death at 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it was strange, but at 2 a.m. in the intensive care, with my mother's pulse dropping, heart rate dropping all the way down to 17, she was on a nasopharyngeal tube. They had still not intubated her. This was the 6th occasion if she had been intubated. And we were conversing. If she had been intubated, we couldn't have spoken because the tube would have prohibited that, prevented that. So here we had a long conversation, and perhaps that was his plan as well. And I asked her, I said, did you ever feel pain in all these occasions? And she said, no. Nature has a way of blocking that pain. Then I asked her, I said, are you going to pass? And she said, yes, I am going to pass. I know I'm going to pass. Oh. And I asked her, are you afraid? She said, what have I got to be afraid of? I've lived a clean life. I love God. I know He will be there. I have nothing to worry about. I will always be with you, and I will bless you, and I will take care of you. There will be nothing to fear. I have seen your younger brother. He was in Dubai at that time, and I was shocked. I've seen your elder sister. She is in New Delhi. And she said, Dad, I've seen him as well. She used to call him Mapale, my father.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, it hits you when she says you've seen. When you hear somebody who's on the deathbed saying, I've seen them all, it makes you wonder. She had this absolutely serene look about her. Absolutely serene. She told me to cover her. She told me to prop her up in the hospital bed, which I did in the intensive care. And she died in exactly the same position without moving a millimeter. And I went into the deepest slumber, which I've never done in the hospitals. And at 8:15, 8 o'clock around that time, the bells went off and it was, you know, code blue. And the doctors ran in, the nurses ran in, everybody tried to revive her, use the defibrillator, tried to shock her. But her eyes were open and she was gone in exactly the same position, and I knew that she knew. And that conversation was very real. So I was not at all disappointed. I was happy for her. I knew she had gone on to something better.
Wow. I think people who have lived very fulfilling lives, you know, very spiritually enriching lives, know the moment before it really comes. And for your mom to tell you that, yeah, she is moving on and she's happy about it and going away in that very serene way while being in the hospital, even though there are all those equipments and all that is happening around in terms of machines and everything. But she was actually not so connected with that. They're just happening as a matter of course. And you were doing your duty as a matter of course. But she was in a different plane. And all this became very clear once you saw her with Swami.
You know, I would like to share one example of what kind of torture she went through. Just in February of that year, 1995, the doctors cried because they tried to find a vein to put the intravenous feeds in. And they couldn't find a vein. They poked her close to 200 times, and they could not find a vein. Eventually, they put an arterial line, and arterial lines generally are not used for feeding because it's positive pressure, and it's the reverse flow. And, you know, but that was it. Her body had become so dry, so brittle, and she whimpered through, but she told the doctors, do your job. And that was her spirit, her mettle, her strength of mind, of character. And the doctors were crying while they were trying to poke her with these because her veins had dried up. That was the kind of torture she went through. And yet she had this unshakable belief in God, in Swami. She had absolutely unshakable belief. And she said, everything will be fine. This is only a body. This is not the real me. And she was very pure. You know, Swami says, fear sin, love God, and don't be afraid of death. And she epitomized all of that.
Amazing. And Bhagavan always says, you know about the person more about the nature of the person's death. Because that perhaps is a very good indicator of the kind of life the person has lived. And I think that way every mother in this world is blessed. And you had the opportunity to actually see that, experience that, and had the chance to actually serve and then receive also this blessing from Bhagavan, where he showed you that she's happy with him.
That she had reached him.
She has reached him.
Yes.
Fantastic. And I think Bhagwan, that's why in every discourse, you know, whenever he talked about worshipping God, whenever he talked about worshipping Devi, especially during Dasara, he came back finally to worshipping Mother Nature, worshipping, you know, the five Matas, Deha Mata, Go Mata, Bhu Mata.
Mm-hmm.
So Bhagwan came to worshipping cows and worshipping the nature, worshipping Mother Earth, worshipping your physical mother, and in the end only comes the divine, you know,
mm-hmm.
in this series of personalities and beings, the entities to which we have to offer our worship and offer our reverence. So it's really fantastic, and I'm elaborating on this only because this is something that Bhagwan stressed so much.
Very much
so. And your life has been a real life experience of this dictum of Bhagwan.
I've been blessed with that opportunity. So nothing else really matters. You know, my career didn't matter. Nothing mattered. Money didn't matter. There was always the odd concern, but it really, there was a line, Thomas Gray's poem, which prepared me for all of this when I was in school, when I was in my eighth grade, around the same time when I, about maybe a couple of years before I got Swami's Darshan first time. Thomas Gray's, you know, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. And that line epitomized for me that it would be futile to just seek fame and fortune and money, and that there are more weighty matters that one has to focus on. And that connects with my spiritual quest from a young age. So I was always cautious about searching for glory seeking the path which would lead to glory. I was always conscious about being conscientious in life.
But how did this connect happen, that the path to glory is the path of serving parents?
No. Let me rephrase that or re-explain. There's the line in his where he says the heraldry of your family, your background, pomp and power and all of this is going to lead to the grave, which means whether or not you become rich and you aspire for all of these pomp, power, of family, bloodline and fame and fortune and money and riches, you're going to die. So you may as well die in a noble way than seek this path, which is materialistic. So that stuck in my mind from a young age. And for me, I thought the path of glory is more, it's more legitimate when you find something more weighty like this, like caring for people, being compassionate, serving your parents, being truthful to people around you, doing the best you can for society, being compassionate to people. That is the path of glory that I sought.
So these learnings had come from your readings?
From school, from a very young age. And so it all fell into place when I read Ramana's books and when I read Swami's discourses.
So at that point in time, it had nothing to do with Swami?
Nothing at all. But it stuck in my mind.
Yes.
You see, poems can make a huge impact on children.
Yes.
And that line stuck in my head, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. That means don't seek those things which are wrong. And Swami has said that, right?
Yes.
You turn the key left, it goes worldwide,
yes,
to the world side.
Yes.
You turn the key right and it goes towards divinity.
Yes.
And that, in another way of saying that is, your hands in society, head in forest. Another way of saying that, like Jesus said, another way of saying it is, you know, the paths of glory lead to the grave. So be very careful about what kind of glory you're aiming for or seeking. And for me, the glory path was serving.
Amazing. It's really significant that even though physically Bhagwan had not directed your understanding in terms of serving the parents is the highest thing, but invisibly he was directing your life. Invisibly he had led you on to that path so that you had that blessing. And with time, you then discovered him more and then realized that how you are actually walking on the path that he always wanted you to walk on.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So, after this, when did that realization come that, you know, thanks to him that he's actually guided my life invisibly all this while?
That consciousness struck me only in 2008-2009. More so in 2009, and a lot of events happened prior to that. So we are talking about a gap now of 15 years between 1993 and 2009, so 16 years, 15, 16 years. a lot of events happened. Like I said, when Swami touched me and when he himself ran to me, it was because of the urgency of the nature. He knew what was coming. So the significant thing about him lifting his robe and running was like a mother. A mother runs to a child who she sees is going to be in danger. He saw that I was in danger. He saw my mother was in danger. What was coming in ahead of us? All that hospitalization, everything. And then he knew what was going to come ahead of me, my life, the difficulties, the divorce, the problems, the isolation, the segregation, being in a country all alone by yourself, drained of money, lost your job, being income-less, and all the struggles. Perhaps karmically I had to go through all those experiences, and I'm glad for that. You know why? Because it made me seek divinity. And all of these problems, University of Hard Knocks, were necessary for me to seek that path of glory and understanding on who he was and where he was. So, you're familiar with Jim Sinclair?
Yes.
The great Jim Sinclair, very close to Swami. He says it in his interview. He says that he knew that God existed, but he didn't know where God existed, and he didn't know where he was, because he prayed to Jesus. And 30 years later, Swami appeared in his house in Connecticut, yes. Right? And in the flesh, he appeared in his house, and Jim Sinclair is on video. And Jim Sinclair is a gold billion trader in the United States. And I have a great deal of respect for him because of his accomplishments, and he's a billionaire. And we shared the same field. He's in the securities field, and I was in the securities field as well, practicing for a while with the Securities Exchange Commission and the Enforcement Division. So it connected with me. And his experience, he's gone on video and talked about it. So this was like Swami appearing to me in Delaware when he started coming in a series of visions and dreams. After my life took another turn for the worse, so it seems. But it was really for the better because consciousness was seeping into me. That was the time when the economy crashed in 2008. The world went crazy, you know, the CDO, the mortgage scam. And I lost my job. I was fired on April 1st, the same day that the divorce occurred. So I had a double whammy. I was divorced and I lost my job. And then 6 months later, all hell broke loose and the world was in a mess. And I lost my second job. And not just me, millions of Americans lost their jobs because every month about 1.5 billion people were losing their jobs. And it was a mess. It was a complete chaos in America. And I was divorced. After 14 years of marriage, the same wonderful person. The greatest blessing I had was her, because she also took care of my mother in the hospital. And I'm very indebted to her for that. She was a wonderful companion. She's got Swami's Pad Namaskar. But then, like Swami says, nobody belongs to you. You come as twigs in water, and then you separate as twigs. Our karmic journey was over, and we split. I recognized that. I did not want to hold on, no possessiveness, let it go. When my life, he wanted me isolated. He isolated me so that he could have me start pondering about these imponderables, these very deep things about life. And that's when Swami arrived in his grand appearance in Delaware, in a series of visions and dreams. That's when everything hit me hard.
Mm-hmm. So this was a time when you were in so much of turmoil, from various angles. So were you really looking for Bhagwan? Were you really seeking him, or it just happened?
It just happened. I did not think about him. I had in fact forgotten about him. I didn't know who he was. And remember, as I mentioned earlier, I was not totally sold on his divinity. I know a lot of things happened. He materialized. He knew what was going on in my mind and all that. But I really did not still buy into that he was divine.
So you were not like kneeling down and praying and asking, "Where are you, God? Please come on."
No, I did pray to God. I did pray. Okay. I prayed and I said, "Why is this happening?" Because it was shocking to me.
But you're open to God, not to Swami.
No, not to him. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten who he was. I'd forgotten where he was. I'd forgotten that he even existed. Mm-hmm. Let me share one little bit. In 2005, I did come down with my wife to Puttaparthi.
Mm-hmm.
In August. I think the dates are August 14, 15, 16th or 15, 16, 17, Independence Day, around that, India's Independence Day. When I saw Swami in a wheelchair, I lost all my little faith that I had. And that takes a lot. You know, when I saw him in a wheelchair, I said, if he is divine, why is he allowing himself to be in a wheelchair? Now, these questions were answered later, after 2009, because everything fell into place. And now there's absolutely no question in my mind that Swami is divinity incarnate. There's no question at all. Nobody can shake that out of me. But it took this journey of so many decades for me to understand that. And that was the beauty of the journey, because now I've learned my lessons really hard and they're not going to be shaken out of me. And his appearances there, that really started the ball moving. And in a series of dreams, extraordinary, extraordinary experiences, uninvited, unsolicited. He was not even sought after by me, but he appeared. Now the question is, how did he know where I was? How did he insert himself into my consciousness or subconsciousness, should I say? How were those so lucid that they seemed so extremely real? And why me? And why that time? So I had to experience those feelings.
Amazing. I mean, so it's really significant that you were praying, you know, you were praying to a God. And that is when Bhagavan entered.
Yes.
So even though at that point in time, you did not look for him, but when you looked for an energy, you looked for the solace, you know, I think that was the perfect moment for him to actually come and barge into you, and perhaps the perfect moment for you to gain that understanding. I think there is no better teacher in life than suffering. I think when it comes to really spiritual growth, you grow more when you suffer. I think that's why you had in the Mahabharata Mother Kunti praying to Krishna that, you know, please bless me with more sorrow. Yes. Nobody asks that.
Yes.
But sorrows have a way of ensuring that we grow.
Yes.
And I think it was one such moment in your life which Bhagwan took to ensure that you take a leap, a giant leap now in your progress.
Sai Ram, you just heard the first part of a conversation with Mr. Raj Srivatsan from the United States, an experienced corporate and securities attorney with a management consulting background. Mr. Raj moved to the US in the year 1999. As of November 2016, when this conversation was recorded, Mr. Raj continued to be engaged in class and derivative litigation as counsel for the boards of Fortune 500 companies and also working to defend directors and officers through U.S. corporate law firms. He has assisted justices and judges at the Supreme Court of Delaware and federal bankruptcy courts in public service, also at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's Enforcement Division to prosecute Wall Street corporate and securities fraud. More importantly, Mr. Raj is a visiting faculty to the Prashanthi Nilayam, Brindavan, Mudanahalli and Anantapur campuses of the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. In conversation with him was Radio Sai's Bishu Prashti. Dear listener, you may send in your feedback as always to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you and Sai Ram.